Hi everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast, and welcome back to my normal guest, Andrew Dixon.
Thanks, Russ. It's good to be back.
We'll start with some news, Andrew. One interesting thing came out this week that Charlie Burke, surprisingly, because his two major tournaments in 6 months, is leaving Hong Kong for a job at the High Performance Program in Africa.
Very bad news for Hong Kong, coming that, as it does at such a crucial time for them with, as you say, two World Cup qualifying tournaments coming up. And he's done a good job with the team over the last few years, and I hope they can get another coach as good as Charlie Burke. It's unfortunate at this time.
Yeah, he's left a very good legacy to that side. A lot of young players, very exciting side, and also the girls this week were in Melbourne training, so expanding into the local area and getting those contacts. A lot of Chinese nationals starting to come into the side as well, so very disappointing for Hong Kong, but hopefully he'll be able to do some good work in an area that probably needs it as well.
Yeah, he's going to be working with the top African teams, so Kenya, Uganda, Namibia, and hopefully he can maybe bring them on, maybe get Kenya back up to where they used to be and get Namibia playing well in one-day cricket as well as in four-day cricket.
There's also some news came out about the America's divisional structure that's coming up. Surprisingly small groups by the looks of things.
As with IC Europe, IC Americas have had a bit of a cull of teams. Basically, Division 3 will be just three teams, Panama, Argentina and Belize. Division 2, then Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, Suriname and the winner of Division 3. And Division 1, Canada, Moody, USA and then the winner of Division 2. It's a very small structure. It almost seems pointless having such short tournaments. Obviously, this has been done for financial reasons. Some teams missing out here. Turks and Caicos Islands, probably the most notable absentee from this new structure. I think they finished third in Division 2 last time. So they essentially were ranked seventh in the Americas and are nowhere to be seen in this new nine-team structure. It's very disappointing for them.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused by this. I know that they're doing the financial reasons to try and reduce the number of teams, and that makes a certain amount of sense, but then by having three tournaments, that they've still got those fixed costs moving officials around and all those other things, so it doesn't seem like it's actually going to save a huge amount of money. And yeah, it'll be and presumably they're going to be there for a week still. They'll play, you know, double matches instead of single matches, so it may not really make much of a difference.
No, and likely to be, you know, Division 2 could probably be hosted in the Bahamas, and Bahamas isn't a cheap place to send even just a few teams. So it seems very bizarre. I don't think it's going to save money. You could maybe have gone for two divisions or maybe even just one division and have a 19 qualifier.
The other option, of course, though, in this small one is perhaps they should be beginning to look at, rather than having these regional tournaments, looking at doing home and away qualification and having teams given the opportunity to play single matches at their home ground. Is that perhaps even a better structure?
Possibly. That can have the problems with players getting time off work. Flying into one country and playing several matches is probably going to take less time away from work than flying into several countries to play, you know, one or two matches in each country. So I can understand the having several teams in one location, but, well, it isn't several teams in one location, it's just three or four. Yeah, it's a very odd structure. It doesn't really make sense. Something else coming out up from the Americas is that the affiliate nations will no longer be allowed to take part in the under-19 competitions. So it will just be the associate members playing that tournament. So Canada, Bermuda, Suriname, the Caymans and Argentina, which is, again, very unfortunate for a team like the Bahamas, who are having quite a decent under-19 team and were probably better than Argentina.
Yeah, I mean, on the plus side, it will give them an incentive to maybe look for that, do what they need to do to get associate membership. So hopefully that is at least one reason to do that.
Yes, absolutely. And the Bahamas are certainly the strongest affiliate in the Americas region, so probably aren't that far away from associate membership anyway.
Let's move on to some matches. A little while ago now, but the Canada hosted the UAE. The I-Cup match was a draw, even though Canada was dominant almost throughout. Kurram Khan managed to stave off the defeat with a really, basically got batting all day.
Sort of good battling performance from the UAE to salvage the draw. Wasn't really surprising after there was no player for day one and most of the second day as well. Apparently it rained overnight on the Wednesday, and there was no rain actually on Thursday and for most of Friday. At one point on Friday they got the field all ready, players were about to come out, and then it started raining again, which is very unfortunate. In the end, a rather unsurprising draw after so much play was lost.
Yeah, this facility is having a lot of issues with rain, and I believe we're informed by Penn Della Penna that there's problems with their drainage that was damaged in hosting an international game. That's something that really needs to be fixed up with maybe some funding.
Yeah, and also the ground actually slopes up from the square area rather than slopes down like you would maybe expect. So that creates problems with drainage. You tend to get sort of big pools of water on the outfield. So hopefully you can invest a bit of money and clean up the facility.
In the WCL games, the UAE needed to win both, and they did so. It was a very impressive performance.
Yeah, as you say, very impressive. Shaiman Anwar scored 102 in the first game. UAE won by 46 runs. And then in the second game, which the UAE won by 2 wickets, much closer contest. But the UAE, the better team. And again, Shaiman Anwar in the runs with 57. Rizwan Shima took 4 for 16 for Canada. It's a sort of first decent performance he's put in for a long time, although he's since found himself dropped from the side. I watched some of this match on live streaming. The pitch was taking a lot of turn right from almost from ball one. UAE, when they bowled, I think, bowled about 45 overs of spin. Obviously, UAE have better spin bowlers than Canada, and it was UAE came out on top.
And there was also matches in Namibia. Afghanistan toured there and won everything inside with really just stamped their class all over what we thought would have been a much closer contest than it was.
Yeah, certainly the Intercontinental Cup, I was extremely shocked at the poor performance from Namibia. Namibia were a very strong four-day team, and I was expecting to put up much more of a fight than this. Namibia bowled out for 190 with Nabi taking 6 wickets. Should probably mention Asghar Stanikzai took 5 catches, which is the first time anybody's done that in an Intercontinental Cup game. In Afghanistan, sort of 354 with Stanikzai again with a century. And then Namibia bowled out for 168, leaving Afghanistan just 5 to win with a day to spare. Very poor performance by Namibia, and puts Afghanistan almost certainly in the final. They now need, the only way now that they don't get into the final is if Scotland take all 20 points against Ireland and then Kenya take all 20 points against Afghanistan. And I don't think either of those are particularly likely to happen.
It would seem very unlikely. The WCL matches were just as one-sided. The first one was a 190-run victory for Afghanistan, and the second, 5 wickets with 19 overs to spare, which is a huge net run rate boost, which is probably going to be very important down the track for them.
Yeah, it put Afghanistan up, I think, into third place now. So they're looking sort of very well-placed for to get that second World Cup space, maybe ahead of the Netherlands or Scotland. Netherlands play Canada. There's also always a risk at this time of year in Canada that one of those matches could be rained out, and if that happens, that's the Netherlands' hopes probably lost. Good to see, by the way, Hamid Hassan coming back into the Afghanistan team. He took 4 wickets in that second WCL game. He also actually came out during the tournament that during the match that some county sides had actually tried to sign him for the 2020 Cup this year, but weren't able to, as it turns out that players from associate and affiliate countries are not allowed to act as overseas players in ECB competitions for county cricket, which seems very unfair, and obviously bad luck for Hamid Hassan, who could have got himself a decent contract.
Somewhat odd. I'm not sure, was this an ECB restriction or is it an immigration restriction because they're not considered at that higher standard? Because I know the immigration expects you to be not able to be replaced by someone.
It is an ECV restriction. Something came out about this a few months ago. Tim Wigmore, who writes, I think, for The Telegraph and for a couple of other publications as well, had actually asked about whether Afghanistan players could play as overseas players and was told they can't because they're from an associate or an affiliate country, as they were then. And it seems very unfair. No? And it's obviously a recent directive as well, because Colin Zabuya, the Kenyan leg spinner, played as an overseas player for, I think, Warwickshire about 10 years ago. So obviously that regulation has been brought in since then. Obviously, the European players are okay because they're covered by EU freedom of movement legislation and they can work within the UK without restrictions. So, but for the top associate players from outside of Europe, they can't act as overseas players. It seems very unfair.
Has been a push by England as well to reduce the number of overseas players because of the COLPAC legislation and so forth, and it's obviously part of that. There was an article by George DeBell about the test side that maybe this has reduced the standard of county cricket given some of the players they brought into the side. So hopefully that might turn around. It tends to ebb and flow, and maybe in the future we'll see it repealed.
Yeah, and Hamid Hassan is a world-class bowler. I think he's one of the best fast bowlers in international cricket today. And it'd be a shame for people in England to be denied the chance to be able to watch him in action.
Now, the tournament you were at was the European Under-19s. Scotland was the dominant side. Was that a surprise?
It was sort of expected to be between Scotland and Ireland. Scotland and Ireland was scheduled as the last game with the assumption that both teams would be unbeaten going into that. That wasn't the case, although it did end up being essentially a decider. The tournament sort of ended pretty much the way people expected, but in an unpredictable way, if that sort of makes sense. Nobody really expected the Netherlands to lose to Jersey and Guernsey, and nobody expected Denmark to beat Jersey and Guernsey. The Netherlands started really well with the win over Ireland on the opening day. I was at that match and Ireland were completely out of sorts and didn't bowl very well. They have a leg spinner, Rishi Chopra, bowled a ball that actually landed on the pitch next door to the one they were bowling on. One of the worst balls I've ever seen bowled in cricket. And they just didn't play very well and gave away a lot of extras, which almost ended up being the difference in the end. The Netherlands after that were feeling, as you can expect, quite confident. They were practically saying, well, we've beaten Ireland, we've won the tournament. And then they didn't win another game, apart from one more on the last day. And very unfortunate for the Dutch, who were hosting the tournament. Ireland didn't play well, as I said. Scotland, definitely the best team. Bowled well, batted well. Jersey and Guernsey had their moments, especially John DeGenu, who was the player of the tournament. Only 15 as well. He actually played in the under-15s the following week. Played very well. Denmark, although they did win two games, were mostly poor. I sat through the game against Scotland where they were bowled out for 46. They were actually 32 for 1 in that game and collapsed to 46 all out. Farrar taking 7 for 13, which was the best bowling figures in the tournament's history. And the game was over within less than 2 hours. It was a poor match to watch, I can assure you of that. And you know, Scotland sort of didn't look back from there and went on to win the tournament. A thoroughly professional performance as well.
Any particular standout players other than the ones you just mentioned?
Campbell from Ireland played quite well. Costa from the Netherlands as well. Aside from that, not really. Peter Eakin from Ireland was okay, and they had a couple of good quick bowlers whose names escape me at the moment. But their captain was very good as well, Tyrone Kane. Peter Chase was one of the fast bowlers who I think could well go on to represent Ireland. Phil Simmons actually turned up for the last two games, obviously, and was playing close attention to those pace balls, obviously looking for people to be replacing Trent Johnson and Boyd Rankin. Although the rest of the team for Ireland isn't looking good for Ireland's future, I have to be honest. I saw an Ireland under-19 team 5 years ago that featured your George Dockrell and your players of that ilk, and I didn't see anybody who stood out like he did then in this tournament for Ireland, and I think Ireland can be worried about the future.
Yeah, these things tend to go up and down, especially at an under-19 level, so you can't necessarily expect a player of Dockrell's standard every under-19, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yes, but you do occasionally get one generation of players that plays very well. It looks like this isn't the generation for Ireland, unfortunately.
There are a couple of women's tournaments last week as well, one in Jersey and one in Italy. You had an interview with Ross Brooks from Cricket Gibraltar about the one in Italy, which we'll listen to now.
Okay, joining us now on the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast is Gibraltar Cricket General Manager Ross Brooks. Thanks for coming on the show, Ross.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
It's a pleasure. You were recently with the Gibraltar women's team at a 2020 tournament in Italy. Started with a win against Belgium. Gibraltar didn't win any other games, but managed to finish third on run rate. What are your overall impressions of Gibraltar's performance?
It was my first tournament away with our women, and we've got a very young squad with about an average age of 17. So we weren't expecting a tremendous amount of wins from the tournament. It was really for us about the performance and how the girls learnt and adapted as they went on, and I think we saw certainly lots of encouraging signs from them during the tournament and their attitude and their approach to the cricket, which was really, really encouraging for the future.
And it was only really the game against Italy where they were sort of completely outclassed, wasn't it?
Yeah, although in saying that, the Italians had a very good side out there and probably seen bowlers of pace that our girls have never faced before. Within that, the performance to make them work for the runs, chasing and the effort and commitment they put in the field was really impressive to myself and our coach, Mark Baccarese.
And other than sort of the Italians, did any other players sort of impress you during the tournament?
The Danish squads were very, very well drilled. They're obviously a squad that have been together, or seem like they've been together for a long time, and some very mature cricketers in there. I think Denmark have qualified for a couple of World Cups during their history as well. So it's well ingrained within the Danish cricket culture, women's cricket. The Estonians, extremely enthusiastic. We performed a disappointing performance against them in a game that we feel that we should have won, really. But it was great to see all five sides in the tournament progress as they went through the different tournament stages.
And do you know if there's any plans for a similar tournament next year or the year after?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the head of Italian cricket, Simone Gambino, made a point at the award ceremony at the end of the tournament there that this was really groundbreaking in terms of our level of European cricket, and certainly there's plans between all the sides that they want to repeat that, and hopefully we can do a bigger tournament with some of the other sides that do play women's cricket. And there was another tournament going on at the same time in Jersey where we get a few more of us together.
Do you think that perhaps ICC Europe should step in and organise an official sort of Division 2 tournament?
I think it would be nice. I think there's obviously lots of questions around tournaments going forward. With the opportunities at age group cricket for boys as well being cut from some of the European countries, but I certainly think it will be something that will be discussed when all European members meet later on this year, ironically back in Bologna, around the future of women's cricket.
So moving on to cricket in Gibraltar generally now, you've been in your position for just coming on to a year now. Yes. How have you found it so far?
Really, really interesting, really, really rewarding, and really challenging as well at the same time. So, it's my first full-time role in cricket, and I think we worked tremendously hard to try and improve the culture of cricket within the country, try and improve the profile of cricket within the country. which, you know, albeit it's a very small territory, Gibraltar, it's cricket's tended to be hidden away at the end of the rock. So we've tried to do a lot more sort of PR locally around what we're doing and what we're achieving from grassroots cricket right up to our national men's and women's squads. And also, just try and improve, the perception of cricket in Gibraltar, outside of the country.
And I've noticed as well, you've been adopting, both in the women's team and the men's team, something of a youth policy. A lot of the older players have stopped playing now. You've brought in some very young players who are coming on quite nicely.
Yeah, and I think if you look at our national men's squad, a lot of those have were fortunate enough to come through with, the system when we had the ability to go to European tournaments and play under-19s tournaments, etc. Yeah, so it's we probably have got a problem around the under-19 level now because those tournaments were taken away from us. But we're really if you like starting a game. That sort of under 15, under 13 level and working with these players now, knowing that they're going to be, in 4 or 5 years' time, the ones that, start to move into the national team.
At the Division 1 tournament in Sussex earlier this year, there was sort of an excellent partnership between Kieran Stagno and Kieran Ferrari, which obviously has to be a highlight of your time in Gibraltar so far.
Yeah, it was fantastic to sit in Sussex and watch that partnership unfold. An exceptionally mature display from both of them, really. So the partnership, I know you did a lot of work yourself trying to work out if it was a record from that side. So I think we worked out that it was certainly one of the highest third wicket partnerships in any sort of organised official T20 tournaments for international sides as well. So, the highlight beating Sweden there in the tournament really, and still with the disappointment of losing a couple of games. The guys do feel that they should have won
and finished that tournament in 10th place as well. Is that disappointing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think we talk about those couple of games. The guys feel that they should have beaten Austria. They feel that they should have beaten Norway as a minimum. And and our performances in the final game against Isle of Man, our performance was below par. But it gives us something to start to work on going forward now.
And in the new structure, it's looking like you'll be in Division 2. How confident are you that you can come up from that tournament, which I think is going to take place next year?
I think, the likes of sort of France and Belgium have shown that, a lot can change in a year. France has obviously, improved a lot over the year, and Belgium have maybe fallen slightly by the wayside and will be disappointed with their performance there. I think what we feel is that will be an exceptionally competitive division. We feel that we should have beaten a couple of sides that will be in that league at the tournament. And I think it's one of those ones where it's too early to say who's going to be the favourites going into that.
And I suppose getting back into the World Cricket League and being able to play 50 over cricket must be a priority as well.
Yeah, I mean, looking at our side, I think our style of play is very much suited to 50 over cricket. I think we would probably be more competitive at 50 over level with the squad we've got at the moment. It's still unclear as to what that pathway is going to be through to back into those tournaments now the World Leagues have been cut. We'll certainly be along with the other European countries seeking clarification as to what that pathway is going forward.
Do you think that the pathways are as clear as they could be?
Not at the moment. I think we've gone through obviously a transitional, phase in the last couple of years. I think, whilst, there's part of me that understands around, the budget, constraints, and cutting back at tournaments, I think, everyone wants to be, playing, at the highest level possible and playing, longer forms of the game as well. So certainly from Gibraltar's point of view. I tend to be, fairly patient with the people that make these decisions but we're working together with them to hopefully understand what that tournament structure is going forward.
Gibraltar is a small place, but do you feel that they generally punch above their weight in international cricket?
I think it goes for all sport really, and you know, from you know, Gibraltar's point of view, I think, you know, we've got a population of 30,000 people. You know, it's, and we've got 2.5 square miles. So within that, we've got, you know, the constraints around the number of players we've got to choose from, but also the amount of facilities we've got as well. So, you know, I think, you know, we can take great pride that we're competing at that level. I think we are competing at that level with that, you know, that population and the amount of facilities. I think, you know, internally, you know, we still, you know, are looking to grow the numbers that we've got, and but also work closely with the government in terms of improving our facilities.
Just going back to 50 over cricket, are there any plans to arrange any sort of bilateral matches outside the ICC structure?
I think it's something we've got to seriously look at. I think, you know, from our side, you know, what we do is we sit down in next month in September and start looking at our budgets for next year. So working out, you know, what our funding is from a from an ICC point of view and from a non-ICC income point of view. Yeah, a lot of it does go back to money. It's tough for guys to get time off work to travel too far.
On a previous episode of the podcast, we briefly discussed the issue regarding the cricket ground, which possibly could be given over to football. Is there any upcoming news on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's still the plan. You know, I think whilst we accept, you know, that the world over football is king, you know, apart from maybe some you know, parts of Asia, you know, we're working closely with the government to try and, you know, push forward a solution that means we have, you know, better facilities than we've got now. You know, that's, you know, there's no getting away from the fact that, you know, the current facility that we have as our main pitch is probably not conducive to producing, you know, the best cricketers. And I think, which I think we've done very well to produce the cricketers we have with those facilities. I know this is something that's going to be discussed in the next government cabinet meeting as well. So, you know, having met with the sports minister recently, so it's, you know, being small as well means you're able to have meetings at that level and try and influence, you know, government right from the top. Yeah, we're working hard alongside Gibraltar Rugby as well, who are looking, you know, getting their European membership to the FIRA, the rugby representative body for Europe as well. So something along a joint solution would work for both sports.
So it's looking like a pretty interesting year ahead for Gibraltar.
Hopefully, yeah, it'll always be interesting. That's guaranteed, and it will always be challenging. But, you know, I do feel we've made a lot of progress in the last year, and certainly over the next couple of years, we want to continue in that vein.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. I think that just about wraps it up.
Thanks very much for having me, Andrew.
No problem.
Other thoughts on that tournament, Andrew? Italy won it in the end over Denmark?
Yeah, and sort of quite convincingly as well, including especially the match against Estonia where they scored well over 200 in their 20 overs. Strangely enough, without making a century, scored 251 for two. No batsman made a century, which is unusual. I assume Estonia gave away a lot of extras. I don't have a full scorecard. Estonia then bowled out for 55. Italy beat Gibraltar by 9 wickets. And generally a thoroughly dominant performance by Italy. They won all the games, and then Denmark only lost to Italy. Beat the other three teams. The other three teams all won one match each against each other. Gibraltar finishing third on net run rate. Dominant performance by Italy. It's good to see Denmark back. I think this is the first time their women's team have played since maybe 1999. So a long time out for them, although apparently they still have some of the same players from 1999, which is a little bit worrying. You'd expect a team to have almost completely changed in 14 years, but it doesn't look like Denmark have. Obviously, Denmark have previously played in World Cups, so maybe you'd expect them to have done well in this tournament. But, you know, every team finished with a win. Gibraltar, Belgium and Estonia all won one match against each other. So nobody went home completely unhappy, except maybe Estonia after conceding 250.
Good to see Italy not only hosting a tournament like this, because it was an ICC affiliated, and also that they're putting that effort into development. They've got a bit of a reputation for just pulling in expats, but they're obviously doing some good work recently, then that's maybe starting to come to fruition.
Yeah, and from what I've been told, they ran this exactly as if it was an official ICC tournament. All the teams stayed at the same hotel, and there was, you know, a notice board over that they had at these tournaments, and in the hotel with all the results on and the scorecards and whatnot, they ran it like an official ICC Europe tournament, even though it wasn't. And from what I hear, Simone Gambino, the president of Cricket Italia, is quite keen to host another tournament next year, and hopefully he can do that. ICC Europe has, to some extent, fallen a bit behind in women's cricket from than the other regions, and this is a start of coming back. Obviously, there's also been the tournaments in Jersey. I believe this was originally one tournament, but ended up being two separate tournaments. So France, Hungary, Germany and Jersey all played in Jersey, with Jersey winning that tournament, beating Germany in the final, and France came third, beating Hungary. Good to see a team like Hungary, only just become an ICC member a year or so ago, playing in this tournament already. Already got a decent women's side. Although, unfortunately, they only managed to rustle eight players at this event and predictably got quite heavily beaten.
ACC Emerging Nations was also on this week. There were a couple of interesting results in this one. It was against the under-23 Test Nations and UAE, Afghanistan, Nepal and Singapore. Singapore had a fairly bad tournament. Nepal almost beat Afghanistan, but otherwise lost all three. And there were some good results from the other side.
That first match between Afghanistan and Nepal was quite remarkable. Nepal needed, I think, 13 runs with five wickets in hand from 2.5 overs. I managed to get balled out for 157. Quite a remarkable collapse, and four of those five wickets to fall were run outs as well. So it seems that they threw away a pretty sort of golden opportunity to beat Afghanistan and make a bit of a name for themselves. But Afghanistan wound up runners by three runs, and then later in the tournament, Afghanistan against India under-23s, an India side packed with IPL and Ranji Trophy players, managed to successfully defend a low total of 184 and restrict India to 156. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to ensure that Afghanistan made the semi-finals. India instead made the semi-finals, where they end up playing the UAE, who, on the same day that Afghanistan beat India, managed to beat Bangladesh under-23s. Shaiman Anwar, that name again, keeps cropping up, scored a century. He seems to be in some very good form at the moment. Scored a century in innings of 202, and Bangladesh are bowled out for 143. Nazir Aziz taking five wickets. Superb performance from the UAE. They got to the semi-finals, fortunately lost against India under-23s. And India under-23s play Pakistan in the final, which takes place after we do this recording.
Yeah, Afghanistan's, it was interesting, they also only lost by two wickets to Pakistan in their thing. In fact, the main reason they missed the semi-finals is because they almost lost in Nepal rather than because they struggled against the full members under-23 side. So slightly odd mix of results, but interesting tournament and good to see that those sort of things happening as well.
Good to see the ACC try to make out that this is a part of increasing opportunities for associate members, which I think is a little disingenuous when you consider that they used to play in the Asia Cup itself against the full size of the full members, and now they're playing against the under-23s, which seems a little unfortunate, and hopefully when the new TV deal for the Asia Cup is redone, they can start including maybe at least one associate side in the Asia Cup, if not two. And hopefully we can see the likes of Afghanistan playing ODIs against the top Asian countries on a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely. The Asia Cup itself seems to be in a bit of a limbo at the moment because it's supposed to coincide with a tour of New Zealand. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at that end. But yes, in the future, hopefully it'll be expanded rather than contracted or removed completely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the associate sides need more opportunities against full members. Playing against the under-23s is all well and good, but you want to be playing against the big boys.
Finally, Scotland and the Netherlands have played their final matches in the YB40 and then the last of the associate involvement in that tournament. Your thoughts on the legacy of that involvement?
We'll start with the Netherlands. They had a very good season last year. Won about half a dozen games. Well, they didn't do enough to get to the semi-finals. Both Netherlands and Scotland have had poor seasons this year. Ireland obviously used to play in these tournaments. They withdrew about 5 or 6 years ago. Especially for Ireland and Scotland, and obviously Scotland now, would rarely have their best players because their best players play county cricket. And that's true to a lesser extent for the Netherlands as well. So you're playing with a weakened side against teams playing at full strength, and it doesn't look good to say, well, we want more matches against full members, but we can't beat county sides. That doesn't look good. I think Ireland realised that, and I think that's why Ireland withdrew from these tournaments a few years ago. It's brought a lot of attention to cricket in Scotland and the Netherlands, especially when the Netherlands were winning all those matches last year. It's also helped develop facilities, especially in the Netherlands. When the Netherlands started playing in English domestic cricket in the late 90s, they had only one ground with a turf pitch. They've now got 5 or 6 because they needed to have more grounds that could host these matches. So it's helped bring the Netherlands on in that regard. Obviously, Scotland already had several grounds with turf pitches. Even before then, Scotland's involvement goes back 30 years, and I'm sure they'll be disappointed to end, but hopefully they can now schedule more matches, more ODI matches, where they'll have their full strength side available and they can show their real strength on a more regular basis, provided they can get the players released by counters, of course.
Yeah, obviously the ICC has strict regulations on when you can and can't release those players. The other thing, obviously, is that with this push towards more first-class competitions within the Scotland and the Netherlands and maybe even a pan-European type thing, that is effectively a replacement for this type of involvement and probably will give more opportunities to players anyway, although maybe not as a higher standard.
Yeah, and that is certainly the idea. There was some discussions going on about that tournament while I was in Holland between various representatives of Cricket Ireland and the KNCB, and hopefully that tournament can get off the ground. I believe the plan is to essentially the Irish team matches that are a part of the European League will also be part of the Interprovincial League, so it'll be a match that essentially counts for two competitions, which is how they'll get around some of the how they get around the problem of fitting it into the calendar. So hopefully that league can be launched. It'll be a 7-team league to start with. I think there was some hope that there'll be an 8th team, maybe from one of the other European sides or a best of the rest sort of team, but they're going to start with just the 7 teams. And hopefully it can perhaps expand in the future and eventually become a fully fledged, your top level competition.
In the long term, you have to wonder what it can do in relation to the county game, that type of competition. Should we be aiming for matches between the top county side and the winner of that, or should it become a lower division of the county system so that you could actually be promoted from that league into the county thing? Numerous possibilities at that time.
I think it should remain separate from the county system. There is some merit in maybe two teams from this could take part in some sort of knockout competition within the ECB structure. I was always a fan of the old NatWest Trophy when it was a knockout team and the minor counties took part in the combined universities and things like that. And I think a knockout 2020 tournament could certainly work within England, and maybe teams from this European League could take part in that, similar to the Heineken Cup in rugby union.
There's a couple of articles on Cricket Info this week about associate cricket. Somewhat related to associate cricket because it came up. There was a Cricket Info 11 of associate history and looking at the best players over time. Your thoughts on that? Who was missing? Who shouldn't be there?
They limited themselves to one player from each country, which is fair enough. I'll run through the players. Had Mohammad Shahzad from Afghanistan, Sheridan Rayner from Bermuda, Steve Ticklow from Kenya, Ryan Tendriscard from the Netherlands, James Aitchinson from Scotland, Jerry Snyman from Namibia, Niall O'Brien from Ireland, Basil Robinson from Canada, Bart King from USA, Ali Morrison from Denmark, and Clem Gibson from Argentina, who, as an aside, was the first associate player ever to be off running non-test countries to be Wisden Cricketer of the Year many moons ago, around the time of the First World War. Obviously, there's some names that you find it hard to disagree with. Bart King is one of them. I think Bart King has to be in any list of this sort. Ollie Mortensen, again, a very talented fast bowler. Cricking for having him in their batting order at 10, which seems unlikely. Ollie Mortensen was such a bad batsman, he actually batted in the batting order behind Devon Malcolm when he played for Derbyshire. So I'm not sure how he could possibly be 10 in any batting order. So that seems odd. Steve Tickle, it's hard to argue against his inclusion, and same with Mohammad Shahzad to some extent. One, you know, it does say best 11 players from associate countries. The description is a look at some of the players who missed out on Test cricket because came from associate member countries. Now, it's hard to give that description to Ryan Tenderskater. He was born in South Africa. He came up through the South African system. And he actually remains eligible for South Africa. There's nothing to stop him playing for them now. So you can't really say that he's been denied Test cricket. So I'd maybe take him out of the team. Basil Robinson, as a spin bowler, I don't think he's probably the best spin bowler from an associate country. There's a guy from Bermuda. Yeah, Gerald Conyers, who had a superb run just before the First World War over, a six-match streak with five games against Philadelphia and one against Australia. He took 63 wickets, an average of about 12, which is an absolutely remarkable performance. One game against Philadelphia, he took the last six wickets to fall for just two runs in two overs with a hat-trick in each over. Only once in those six matches failed to take 10 wickets in the match, took five wickets in the innings 10 times. Absolutely superb spin bowler who you'd probably put in the team. That had been having to take Sheridan Rayner out. Maybe you'd look at bringing in... It's hard to actually pick a team with this restriction of one player per country. Who you bring in to replace Sheridan Rayner, and obviously to replace Ryan Tenderskater, who we don't want in the side. You'd maybe look at bringing in an Irish batsman, maybe Ed Joyce, but then you can't argue that Ed Joyce didn't have the opportunity to play Test cricket as well. He spent a six-year period where he was eligible to play for England. Obviously, never played Test cricket. That you put that in, you take out Niall O'Brien. You still have Mohammad Shahzad in as a wicketkeeper, but Mohammad Shahzad is, I think, more of a batsman. He's not brilliant behind the stumps. Maybe you'd bring in someone like Ashish Bagai as the Canadian representative instead of Basil Robinson. There's a lot of changes you could make to this side. Maybe you'd have Roland Lefevre in as the Dutch representative instead of Ryan Tenderskater. There's a whole host of changes that you could make, but it just shows how hard it is when you restrict yourself to just one player from each country.
Another interesting sideline of this is that a lot of the players are current associate players. Is associate cricket the best it's ever been? Or we just not remember the history?
Oh, that's a $6 million question, isn't it? I think there have been better players in the past. I think the number of good players is probably higher now than it has been in the past. But the good players in the past are perhaps better than the good players now, if that makes sense. You're obviously a name like Bart King, who is, I think, will remain for a long time the top name ever to come out of a non-test playing country, and will remain so for a number of years. I think I said in a comment on this side, not having Bart King in a list like this would be like not having Don Bradman in a list of best Australian cricketers, which is probably a fair point. So, yeah, Bart King obviously is always going to be a name when you look at these sort of lists, and there were other players around the time as well, other players in the US, Percy Clark, George Patterson as a batsman, and other players around the world in the past have been maybe better than the players now, but there are now more good players. The strength and depth is probably there more now than it has been in the past.
There was also a conference for the Cricket Info about the future, the interminable question about the future of Test cricket, which had Nasser Hussain, Ed Smith, Mark Nicholas, and Representative Sky, whose name escapes me, but who was actually one of the more lucid people on the panel.
And Rahul Dravid, of course.
And Rahul Dravid as well. Let's forget Rahul Dravid. You were somewhat annoyed by a few of the comments made within this?
Yeah, their vision of the future, which is being hailed as visionary and in some areas, seems to be, well, let's carry on like we are. Let's keep to these 10 teams. Let's stop these pesky associates from coming up. Rahul Dravid was talking about stronger countries helping out weaker countries, and his ideas was South Africa helping out Zimbabwe, England helping out the West Indies, India helping out Bangladesh. No mention of England helping out Ireland or Scotland or the West Indies helping out Canada or the US or South Africa helping out Namibia and Kenya, Australia helping out Papua New Guinea. That's what I see as stronger countries helping out weaker countries, because whatever you say about the money that goes into associate cricket, and Nasser Hussain had a lot to say about that, they'd still get a hell of a lot less than even those weaker full members. Zimbabwe get, I believe, it's something like $11 million funding annually from the ICC, whereas Ireland, I think their base funding is $300,000 a year, and they get another $500,000 a year from the TAP funding. So they're getting less than $1 million a year. So there isn't that much money being put into associate cricket, despite what Nasser Hussain might say. And Nasser Hussain went on to talk about how the World Cup should be cut back even further to 8 teams for a short and sharp format, obviously not realising that it's not about the format. It's the format is what makes it short and sharp. It's not the number of teams. But you sort of expect this from full member players. It's depressingly familiar. Nasser Hussain as well talking about should we be funding cricket in the US and China? And it seems that every other sport, with the exception of football, which is sort of king almost all around the world, he's talking about how can we get more people playing our sport? How can we get more countries playing at a higher level? And cricket former players in cricket seem to be saying, well, why should we bother? Why not? Let's just stick with what we've got. Let's look after our own. Let's not spread the game around. Let's not have these teams take part in tournaments. And it just seems bizarre. Why wouldn't you want more countries around the world playing your sport? It seems bizarre, but I've learnt not to be surprised by this.
Yeah, absolutely agree. One of the things too, in terms of growth, there's not going to be a lot of growth inside the existing Test nations if you're looking to expand the number of people playing or so forth. So, because they're already relatively high up. Maybe Zimbabwe, because they haven't really tapped into their black population, but and Bangladesh still developing their population a lot, but they're a very poor country. But otherwise, the majority of the growth for cricket, if cricket is going to grow in terms of its finances, and that's going to be good for all nations, is going to come in the associate nations. So they really need to be the ones that you're looking to market to. And the World Cup, I can see the appeal of an 8-team World Cup, but there were two things about it that really struck out for me. One is that it completely misses how important the global event is in showcasing the sport to other markets. Because if you look at the American press, the only time you see anything about cricket really is when there's a world tournament on. You would never see it for any other match. And that's the only time, if that's the only time you're getting that kind of leverage and coverage, you've got to make that as wide and as inclusive as you possibly can to get that key into those markets. And you're not going to get that from having a smaller, shorter thing and then and cutting back on that thing. And for what purpose? They actually talked about reducing the number of bilaterals. The other thing about the World Cup is they wanted to have typical born to rule mentality there, that the 7 will go straight through and that the bottom team, the 8th team, could qualify for everyone else, which is ridiculous, because if you're going to have 8 teams and you're complaining about bilaterals things, then surely you want to make those bilaterals actually mean something by having them as qualifiers. But I could almost understand an 8-team World Cup if there was 25 teams qualifying for that 8 thing and it took a year to get to that point, and Ireland and various other teams, right down, if you're talking 25 teams, it include the USA and teams like that. If they had home qualifiers against England, that would do enormous amounts of development, just as much as having a really inclusive World Cup, course. But if you're just going to go to 8 teams and then have one qualifier go through, it doesn't make a lick of sense.
No, but do we ever expect this stuff to make sense?
Well, I have a few points about that as well, but let me say a couple of other things. One other thing that came out of it was it's pretty clear that they don't understand finances at all, how cricket's finances work. Obviously, the NASA's claim about Zimbabwe and Bangladesh being underfinanced when, one, neither of them are actually large markets. So if you look at the, Soccernomics book or something like that, they basically say GDP is the biggest determiner of how good your team is going to be. And Zimbabwe is one of the poorest countries in the world, and Bangladesh is very big, but actually not a terribly large team. So Zimbabwe also doesn't have any more players than all of the associates do these days. I've actually asked a few times to see how many players they are, and they can't really tell me, but I'm pretty sure it's no more than Ireland. So there's no point giving them as much front money as the other 96 test nations combined, or pretty much to it, if they're not actually going to be a big market anyway. Because they're an existing test nation that they're getting that money. It's not because there's actually potential within that market. But the same with Bangladesh. Look, Bangladesh is a big country, and I'm sure they could do well, but they're not actually a bigger market or even a more likely to be a better team than someone like Ireland is, because they're not for all their population, they don't have the finances to make themselves a good thing. And it was fascinating to watch the questions to the Sky representative, because they're clearly befuddled by this notion that Sky sets the schedule. Because they kept asking, what would you do if it was just given the test program and nothing else? And he said, well, we take it because that's what we do. It's obvious that they think that the TV people are controlling the schedule, and that's completely the opposite way around. The ministers control the schedule. If the ministers wanted to make an inclusive and large World Cup, Sky would buy it. They'd give them money. They might give them less money than they give them now. And that would flow down to the players. The players would get less money, and maybe there'd be less development. But ultimately, the TV people don't control the sport. There's no market outside of the cricket administrators where you can lose players from Test cricket to T20 cricket. There's no market for the players to disappear into some other TV thing because the TV is controlling the schedule. And if you don't schedule enough T20 games, then they're just going to go and play them somewhere else. That doesn't happen. That hasn't happened since Kerry Packer took control of cricket. And that was for basically 2 years, and then it went back to the way it was. So it's very strange the way they think, and they're all staggered by the idea that they might have to share revenue because England and India and Australia earn 10 times what everyone else does. It's very strange for me, and it's quite clear to me that the cricketers, even the well-respected ones, are terrible entrepreneurs. They have no idea about sport business. They don't have inventive ideas. They just keep regurgitating the same talking points.
It does. It just seems like there's a distinctly myopic vision of the future, that they don't know how to see beyond the very small picture of their own experience. I've said it before, I think probably even on this podcast, that they see letting in more teams as having a smaller slice of the pie in terms of the money, when actually you've got a bigger pie. The more teams that are playing at a higher level, the more valuable the things like TV rights become, because you've got more people wanting to watch them. And in some cases, as you were talking about the economic situation in some countries, Ireland has a much stronger economy than many full members, certainly stronger than Zimbabwe and Bangladesh, despite the recession in the EU recently. And Ireland has a culture of subscribing to pay-per-view TV channels and all that sort of stuff, where you have, and same in other countries, Canada or the US, and all these other countries can bring in money to the game if it's marketed well. And it's not marketed well because you see it with the US. What they're trying to sell people in the US is not US cricket. it's cricket from elsewhere. And as long as you try and sell it as a foreign sport for foreign people, people aren't going to be interested into it. But if the US has a US national side playing in that World Cup, people will watch it. As you say, it's the only time it gets coverage in the US media is the World Cup. If the US are playing, it's going to get even more coverage. When in the 2003 World Cup, when Canada beat Bangladesh, that was on the front page of Canadian newspapers. And again, when John Davidson scored his century, that was on the front page of Canadian newspapers. People like success of their own teams. And if they're not playing in the tournament, they're not going to be interested. But such is cricket.
We said it before, but rugby is has that inclusive World Cup, and they include those two nations, particularly Canada and the US, and they're just kind of getting somewhere with what they're doing. And if you look at the results of rugby, it's actually harder to beat a top rugby nation than it is a cricket nation. There's a lot more upsets per game played in cricket than there is in rugby. So it's not as if the mismatches are such a thing. We do worry so much about mismatches, and there's this expectation that every team needs to be as good as India and Australia and South Africa and England. And look, if you look at England and Australia and India are all in the 13 biggest economies in the world, and if economic GDP is the biggest determinant of things, then we are never going to get another country that big unless maybe China or the US takes up cricket, because it's very unlikely any of the other top 13 odd nations are going to get in there, and it's going to take an awfully long time for some of the larger populous nations to get up in terms of GDP to get in. So the reality is we're probably never going to get three really good nations, but we could probably get another 20 nations that are close to the standard of New Zealand and or as close as the standard of Bangladesh or somewhere in that range if we just kind of worked at it a bit. I do want to say, though, that it's worth listening to the Sky representative who was there, because he did talk about narrative and how that's important and what that matters to TV. And narrative is there. He talked a lot of sense, and it's strange that they didn't seem to understand where he was kind of coming from when he says that what we're basically trying to sell is a story, and it doesn't matter to us what that story is or who the teams are or whatever. What matters is that we can sell a story, because that's what it's all about from that entertainment perspective. And cricket doesn't sell a good story. It has great stories within matches, but the actual context of those matches is just abysmal.
Yeah, and you know, we've spoken of the World Cricket League Championship a lot on this podcast, and that's a great story. It has a narrative. You're going into the last round with obviously four countries still fighting it out for one spot. Three countries level on points, another country just 1 point behind. This is a great narrative, but these are the matches that aren't on. Instead, we've got all these meaningless, 25 matches between England and Australia, which they have a narrative maybe within the series or within the match, but externally, that's it. It's set apart. It's like an episode of a TV series that ends up being all a dream. It doesn't really have any impact on the actual TV series, the plot of the TV series itself. And, the Ashes, as decent as a series as it's been, perhaps not for Australia, more for England, when it's over, that's it. It has no impact on anything, because you can argue that there's an impact on rankings, but we all know that the four teams in the Test Championship in 2017 are going to be England, Australia, India, and one other. It's whatever happens, the rankings will be, manipulated is the wrong word, but the system will be gamed to ensure that is a likely result. So it doesn't, none of it really matters in the grand scheme of things. We could talk for hours about this, I'm sure, but and I'm sure we will again. But
we will keep pushing this barrow until we get somewhere. Let's move on to some of those games that we were talking about, because we have to preview a couple of them. Canada's playing the Netherlands in the I Cup at the moment, and Canada's on top, which is a little surprising. Gunasekara has scored a lot of runs recently, and he scored another 150 in this match.
He seems to be in the form of his life at the moment. I think this is his maiden first-class century, although he's obviously scored a century against the US in the two-day OT Cup match. Netherlands, as we speak, he scored 164 in the first innings. They're 169 for four in the second, so still 100 and odd runs behind. But they're in this innings, they're actually scoring the runs quite quickly. They're scoring almost a run a ball. Swazinski's currently unbeaten on 76 as we speak. Seems unlikely that Netherlands can go on and win this game from this position. But it's good to see Canada sort of back in some form. Vivian Kingler actually played in the under-19 tournament. I was at it, took 4 wickets in the Canadian innings. Looks like a pretty good prospect for the Netherlands in future.
The Dallas Steel games will follow. Obviously, they're very important because the Netherlands will be the first team trying to get that the 4 points that they'll need to have probably half a chance of getting that last spot.
You've just got to hope that the weather plays ball and Netherlands can actually get 2 results out of this game. You'd expect the Netherlands to win, but looking at the I-Cup game, looks like sort of Canada are adopting the strategy of, well, we've got nothing to lose. We may as well go out and try and win the games. Obviously, you've brought back Ashish Bagai as captain, and Rizwan Shira has been dropped finally after a number of years of underperformance, it has to be said. And maybe they're going to try and start building towards the future. And what better way to start than by stopping the Netherlands from qualifying for the World Cup? Should mention, of course, that these games aren't going to be live streamed. Though, if you go back to February and the initial announcement of the live streaming of the World Cricket League Championship matches, all 8 of the last round of matches were scheduled to be live streamed, including these Canada v Netherlands games, and now all of a sudden they're not, which there's been no explanation as to why not. It's extremely disappointing, especially as the previous round of matches, all matches were live streamed. They added Namibia and Afghanistan to the streaming schedule, which is great, and then Canada televised the games against the UAE separate from that ICC streaming. But now these matches aren't being live streamed, and they are, as we said, crucial matches. They should be live streamed, and it's unfortunate that they're not.
Yeah, disappointing that Rogers in Canada is not picking up. There was an announcement a couple of days ago that they're starting their own cricket channel. They're putting 10 cricket as a permanent cricket channel in Canada, which is good for the cricket fans in Canada, but it's kind of indicating that Canada is still a little bit like the US in that they have a very large supporter base that doesn't have a huge amount of interest in Canadian cricket.
Yeah, but at least they're actually putting Canadian matches on. You know, that's a start. Yes, it's only on a TV station that's broadcast just in Ontario at the moment, but these matches do get replayed nationally. They're only on live in Ontario. Hopefully, people will see these matches. They'll turn on to this new cricket channel, just flicking through the channels, and they'll see Canada playing. I didn't realise Canada had a team. I'll watch this match. And if Canada can get some money out of this, perhaps through sponsors, you've got TV coverage for your team, you're going to get more money from sponsors. It's a fact of the way cricket is run these days.
Speaking of pointless one-day internationals, they're not entirely pointless. They're probably a good sign of how strong the associates are, but Ireland will be playing England and Scotland Australia in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, as you say, these matches are. I think we said it before when we previewed the Ireland v Pakistan ODIs in May. These matches are to some extent pointless, but these matches are what attracts the crowds. It's what attracts TV companies. The Ireland v England game is going to be on Sky Sports, So they play a role. In the context of the matches is pretty meaningless at the moment. Hopefully, eventually this will be part of in future, a World Cup qualifying system, which is what is looking like is going to be introduced. But they play a role, puts bums on seats in the countries concerned, gets some exposure. But obviously for Ireland and Scotland, the really important games, certainly for Scotland, are those 2 World Cricket League Championship ODIs that are coming up.
One question, and I'm not sure whether it's been answered yet, is whether or not England will play a full-strength side. I know in the past they've tended to downplay this match a little bit. A couple of times it was pretty much scheduled in the middle of a test series. It does make it a problem if the main purpose is to get a chance to see English stars, if they send out what's effectively a second 11.
Yeah, they, it was 2009 when they sort of turned up and Paul Collingwood saying, oh, why do we have to come over here the day after playing the Ashes and all this, and certainly didn't make themselves any friend. Even the coach has rested himself from this game in the past, never mind the players. This year, they do seem to be taking the game a little more seriously. They fly into Dublin the day before the match rather than the day of the match. They're staying in a hotel the night before and they're having training on the ground the day before, and they're not flying away immediately after the game. They're staying behind, you know, staying at a hotel in Dublin. They seem to be putting in taking it more serious than they have in the past, which is good for Ireland. I think the number of tickets already sold for the game already makes it the biggest attended cricket match in Ireland ever, and they're hoping to get a full sellout of 10,000 seats, which would be absolutely amazing. Almost certainly a record for European Associate Cricket. And there haven't been many bigger crowds around the world in Associate Cricket, except maybe in Nepal.
Ireland, as you said, be playing Scotland shortly after. It's Scotland who will be most interested in these games because Ireland's already qualified. They'll know what Netherlands has done, so that'll give them some, but they don't know what Afghanistan will do, so they really need to hopefully win both. But it'll be very hard pressed to do so, they think, unless Ireland picks a weaker squad.
Yeah, and speaking to people involved in Irish cricket, they're not going to be picking a weak side for this. Scotland are their main rivals, and you don't pick a weak side against your main rivals. Ireland are going to put a full-strength side out, and they're going to be playing to win these games. Scotland is their main opponent. They, at European tournaments I've been at, when Scotland and Ireland have played, the players have often said, don't care what happens in the other matches, as long as we beat Ireland or beat Scotland. they don't want to lose that game against the old enemy.
And the I Cup gets will be a dead rubber. I think that will almost certainly have weaker squads because it'll coincide with county matches.
I mean, as we said earlier, it's not completely dead rubber, but Scotland still could theoretically get to that I Cup final, unlikely as that may be. But yeah, Ireland will have a weaker squad, but I'd still back, and as will Scotland, of course. Cal Kurtz, who won't play in the I Cup game, he'll only play in the World Cricket League Championship matches. But I'd expect Ireland still to win that and ensure that Afghanistan are in the final of the I Cup in December.
And finally, I think the Guernsey versus Jersey inter-insular match will be on. Any predictions?
I think this will be a reasonably close game. Obviously, both teams are now in World League Division 5. They're off similar standards. Guernsey are playing at home, so you'd maybe back them to take part. Obviously, this is an old rivalry. The Inter-Insular itself dates back to the 1950s, but obviously the rivalry between Guernsey and Jersey goes back a lot further than that. I'd expect Guernsey to maybe just edge out Jersey, but I think it'll be a close game and an exciting game. It always gets a pretty decent crowd, usually approaching 2,000 people when it's in Guernsey, which is a decent crowd for a country with a population of only about 60,000. So hopefully it'll be a good game. It's a shame it's not been live streamed, but maybe that's something for the future.
Absolutely. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.